You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to our podcast series, Exploring Novel Targeted Treatment Strategies for Optimal Generalized Myasthenia Gravis Care. In this two-part podcast series, we'll focus on one of the more novel treatment approaches to generalized myasthenia gravis, FcRn inhibitors. For our final installment, I am once again joined by Dr. Pushpa Narayanaswamy, Vice Chair of Clinical Operations in the Department of Neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School. It's good to speak with you again, Dr. Narayanaswamy.
Hi, Mel. Glad to be back. What are we talking about today?
Let's get right into the clinical efficacy of these drugs, Dr. Narayanaswamy. Can you start us off by just providing a quick review of some of the main outcome measures of the pivotal trials for these agents?
Okay, so we are talking about the three approved drugs, although there are some very close to completion in trials. So we will focus today on efgartigimod, rozanolixizumab, I may just call that drug Rosie, and we have nipocalimab, as I said earlier, the newest kid on the block. And, you know, it's interesting, the regulatory agencies such as the FDA mandate the use of a patient-reported outcome as a primary outcome measure in most trials, as you know. And one of the most studied, validated patient-reported outcome measures that we have in myasthenia gravis is the myasthenia gravis activities of daily living score. It's, as I said, patient-reported. So there are 8 items. Each item is scored from 0 to 3. So the total score is anywhere from 0 to 24. Now, it's good for us to remember because we want to try and do these. And oftentimes now we have to do these, this scale in the office because the insurers want it before they can approve the drug. And so it's good to remember generally for all myasthenia gravis scores, the higher score is a worse score and a drop in score is a good thing. Now, there are other measures, of course, that we always use in these trials. The common clinician-reported outcome measure or the objective outcome measure, if you will, is the quantitative myasthenia gravis score. And then you have other quality of life, sometimes fatigue measures that are also used as secondary outcomes. Oftentimes, the ADL and the QMG will be the co-primary outcomes.
So the pivotal trials for each of these agents, they looked at scores for on the scale, the MG-ADL scale, correct?
But they looked at them a little bit differently in terms of when they assessed them, what actual parameter they assessed.
And then generally, how did these agents perform in the pivotal trials? Obviously, they were approved, so they must have had some significant clinical efficacy. Can you give us a summary?
You are correct, Mel, they did. Hard to summarize in the length of this podcast details of the trials, but what I'll just say is the way they looked at these, all three drugs met their primary outcome. That is, whatever outcome that the trial decided in terms of to look in terms of improvement in ADL, all of these three drugs met. For efgartigimod, that primary outcome was the proportion of patients who were responders, people who received the drug compared to people who received placebo. And they defined responders as people who had at least a 2-point reduction in the MG-ADL score that lasted for 4 weeks and that had to happen within 4 weeks of getting the drug. So basically, the drug was given 4 injections a week apart. So you're saying 3 weeks. Within 1 more week after that, the responder had to drop their MG-ADL to 2 points, and that had to persist for another 4 weeks. And in that trial, I think 68% or so of the patients who received the drug did well, achieved the responder status, compared to about 30% in the placebo group. And this was all in that first cycle. Now, in the trial for rozanolixizumab, it was changed from baseline in the MG-ADL at 6 weeks. So at day 43, you know, difference in change from baseline between groups. And there were 2 doses in that trial. There was a 7 milligrams per kilogram dose and a 10 milligram per kilogram dose. And of course, the placebo arm. In terms of the results, both the 7 milligram and the 10 milligram achieved this a clinically meaningful, statistically significant difference in the change from baseline in the treated group compared to placebo. So that was the outcome. Nipocalimab, on the other hand, used a slightly different way of measuring the MG-ADL. So they took the MG-ADL and they looked at sustained response, change from baseline. So, but it was not from week one end to week 26. It was 24, I think. Week 22, 23, and 24, all of them combined together, the average change within those two-week periods, you know, that two-week period to show a sustained response again at the end of the trial. Because there's no point in just having a response and, you know, you measure one ADL today and then the next week it's not a response. There's no point in doing that. So they tried to show that sustained response.
So all that is to say that generally these drugs tend to work. They have some efficacious results. What about safety? What type of side effects were observed and reported in the clinical trials for these agents?
Yeah. So, you know, overall safety profile was very reassuring for all this group of drugs, which is really good. Some of the side effects that we saw that came, you know, through as a group were headache. Rosnilixizumab actually had a couple of patients, just a couple, who developed aseptic meningitis. And then nasopharyngitis, upper respiratory tract infection, and urinary tract infection came up. But most often, infections did not seem to be much more compared to the placebo group. There was some increase in the open label trials. Nothing really has panned out that the infection rate is much more. And the infections tend to be sort of these minor ones, urinary tract infection, nasopharyngitis. A reactivation of herpes zoster was seen, I think, in one patient in the nipocalimab study. And then in terms of metabolic changes, nipocalimab, there was a small percentage of patients, about 10%, I think, who were noticed to have low albumin levels. A small proportion of patients had peripheral edema. And it was interestingly not correlated to the albumin levels. At least the levels stayed within the range of normal. How much difference there was from baseline, I do not know. Hypercholesterolemia was seen in a small proportion of patients who received nipocalimab. Again, both the total cholesterol and the HDL cholesterol went up, so the ratio didn't actually change. The clinical significance of this remains to be seen, but I think it's something that we want to keep in mind in patients who have really bad cholesterol or are really bad vasculopaths. I think that's about it. I mean, we don't have very much data in terms of pregnancy, so I think I'll stop there.
The clinical trial setting is one thing. They're very structured. They have to deal with certain parameters. Clinical practice is a completely different thing. So how are you using the FcRn inhibitors in clinical practice today?
Yeah, Mel, of course, you bring up this very important point of generalizability of results of a randomized controlled trial. So we do these trials. It's a very controlled population. We have to have that kind of controlled population so that the only thing we see are the effects of the drug, and that's not modified by everything else. But our patients in my office that I see every day are not the patients who are in the clinical trials. So how then do these results apply to them? Are they the same? Is there anything different in the way we would use it? Well, so in terms of the indications for use, they're going to be the same. You know, efgartigimod is approved for acetylcholine receptor antibody positive GNG in adults. Rosnilixizumab is approved for GMG in adults, both acetylcholine receptor antibody positive and MuSK antibody positive. Nipo is approved for GMG in adults, acetylcholine receptor and MuSK antibody positive, and in children over the age of 12, for GMG. So we obviously go with those parameters, first of all, when we're using them. We don't use them in anybody else. And then the other issue is sort of, when do we decide that we're going to use it? Do we use them on day one? Do we use them on day five? Well, there's a couple of things, right? On month five, there's a couple of things. Why do we want to use them if we want to use them on day one? The nice thing about the groups of both groups of medications that have now been approved, the complement C5 inhibitors and the FcRn antagonists, is their rapidity of action. That is the most interesting thing about them. You know, patients get better sometimes within a week after you give them their shot, and that doesn't happen. The most rapidly active acting drug that we have as of now, you know, amongst the older drugs, is corticosteroids, and they take 2 weeks to even start acting. And we're not talking about pyridostigmine, of course, which acts in an hour, but that is just symptomatic management. We are talking about treatment of the disease. So that is a very, very, very exciting thing, right? To get patients well very quickly. And that's especially exciting when patients are fairly severe at the onset in the disease. You don't want to wait for a long time. You want to get them going. The other side of the picture with the FcRn antagonists is they act quickly. They get patients better, but they actually don't do anything to the disease. We are taking out the antibodies, but we are not doing anything to the mechanics of the formation of those antibodies. So I will typically always want to use them in combination with another drug that actually does something to the formation of the antibodies. And so there's a couple of situations where I use them very early, and that is, I may even use them at onset. So right at the start, you know, I give them an FcRn antagonist first and along with another medication. We can talk about that. So, and that's what I do. I mean, oftentimes I'll say, let's start you on the FcRn antagonist, get you well, continue the FcRn antagonist until the other drug starts acting. And I do this especially in patients where I don't want to give them corticosteroids because they have diabetes, they have hypertension, they are overweight. I don't want to make them worse. Their side effects are concerning. They have mental health issues, and I'm worried about that. So I don't want to give them corticosteroids and expose them to those side effects. So I'll start them on this, but I'll also use maybe azathioprine or mycophenolate or one of those drugs that take several months down the road to act, so that we've get that started, but at the same time, patients don't have to wait that long for effect. Are there patients who I keep on just FcRn antagonists alone? Not usually. I mean, my patients usually are on something else. So that's sort of how I do it. And there are patients in whom, of course, I'll start them on something else, oftentimes corticosteroids or usually corticosteroids because that acts reasonably quickly. And then halfway through, maybe in a month, maybe in 2 months, they're developing side effects or they are getting really not much response yet. And I'm because their disease is severe, it's getting better, but not enough. I'll throw in the FcRn antagonist at that time. So I'm really using it to get those patients sort of improved and then maintain the improvement with other drugs.
All good tips and information, Dr. Narayana Swamy. And continuing along that vein, one final question. You know, everything that you mentioned as treatment considerations and considerations for treatment selection, are there any other considerations to consider? That's an odd way of phrasing that. Considerations to consider, like among special populations, like pregnancy, children, only one is really indicated for a certain group of pediatric patients.
Of course, there's always, and I think in our country, the first consideration is payer. You know, it's very hard to choose, select between these medications or even between the two new groups of medications because each payer has their own sort of tiering or policy about which they'll approve first. And in fact, even the route, for instance, a patient may say, I want to get a sub-Q version of this drug, not the IV version of efgartigimod, for instance. And even the sub-Q, you have two. You have the ones that somebody has to go to their house and give it to them, or they can actually take it from a pre-filled syringe. And there's no uniformity at all. Most often the IV will be approved, but the SQ or the PFS will not be approved, you know, and so on. So it a lot of the selection depends on that. In terms of special populations, I think, you know, again, the safety profile is pretty good, as we said. I'm not worried about, for instance, like in IVIG, you worry about people with renal failure, things like that, chronic kidney disease. Don't have to worry about it here. However, I think pregnancy is a different matter. There's very little data about risks to the fetus, et cetera, with pregnancy. But the most important thing, I think, with the FcRn antagonist is the fact that, as we said in my first podcast, when we talked about the pathophysiology and the, you know, how what the FcRn receptors do in normal health, the baby needs antibodies, and this antibody transfer across the placenta is facilitated by the FcRn receptors, and that happens during the third trimester. So are we going to then continue to give the mom the medication and take the risk that the baby may not have enough antibodies and may be subject to a higher risk of infections? That's one scenario. Or the other scenario is, are we going to stop the drug in the third trimester and sort of prepare, have some other drug? But stopping a drug always has a risk that you can worsen myasthenia gravis. And so take the risk of worsening myasthenia gravis in the mom, you know, and that too in the third trimester when she may go into labor. So I don't think we have enough information about it. I have a published case about that. My patient, actually, the drug was started because the payer insisted on it. She did actually worsen after we stopped the efgartigimod, despite giving her other medications. Went on to have a good outcome, but I had a few nights of lack of sleep there.
So Dr. Narayanaswamy, thank you so much for sharing your experience with FcRn inhibitors for generalized myasthenia gravis. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mel. Absolutely wonderful to chat. So thank you.
We've reached the end of our podcast and our series on FcRn inhibitors for generalized myasthenia gravis. Thank you for listening. We also thank Arginex and UCB, which provided educational grant support for this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com.